Welcome to Paddling Adventures Radio. I'm Sean Rowley, and with me is Derek Specht.
Hello.
How's it going, Derek?
Episode 546. That's a lot of episodes.
Isn't it, though? So that's at least one beer each.
Yep.
That's almost 1,100 beers.
Mm-hmm.
And then when we went to go places and have a couple extras, I got to say we're at least 1,200 beers in.
Got to be. That's a lot of
1,200 times a dime, a can.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
We're rich! I drank myself into a fortune of beer cans. Yeah, 546. We're only four away from 550.
Uh-huh.
Remember when we were happy when we made 50 episodes? Remember way, 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 way back 50 episodes?
I remember realizing that we really sucked back then, so it wasn't really a significant thing hitting 50 episodes. It was like, when are we going to get better at this?
Still waiting.
I know. Still eventually. Waiting. Someday.
Yeah. Hey, I'm having fun doing it,
yep.
so I don't care about you. Well, then, let's get to it, shall we? Got a few things here. Some paddling in different countries, and
there's a few interesting topics coming up tonight.
Oh, the dog. Got to wait till you get to the dog article.
I haven't pre-read this episode.
Oh, you should have. It was good.
I know.
It's got a little bit of everything for everybody tonight.
Oh, the dog sniffer. I know with that one.
The
I sent
dog
that one to you.
He's not
I sent
the
that
dog
one to
sniffer.
You.
There's somebody out there and they're a dog sniffer. sounds like a rude insult.
Sir, stay away from my dog. Stop
Listen
sniffing
here,
him.
Dog sniffer. let's start over in Malaysia first, though. Before we get to the dog sniffing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Sungai Barang, often called the Little Amazon of Terengganu. A pristine river in Kuala Barang, Malaysia, famous for its crystal clear waters, lush rainforest. It is a premier destination for gentle ecotourism.
What does that mean, gentle ecotourism?
Wildlife spotting and cultural kayak tours.
No. Oh.
Gentle, nothing extreme, nothing exciting.
No zip lines, bungee jumping, or extreme
water rafting
stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. I came across an article. And it's about one person's reaction to how a kayaking trip along the Sungai Barang changed their perception of outdoor adventures.
Okay.
For people that don't do a lot of it, you know, that like and I'm sure you run into the same thing. When you talk to people, yeah, I'm going on this trip, and I'm going to be doing this, and I'm going to be doing that. And people just look at you like, why would you do that?
Yeah, why'd you pick that? What are you thinking?
What
is going on?
And their perception of what it would be like out there if mm-hmm. they went, until you actually do it,
you don't get
you
it.
You have no
exactly.
clue. And that's like, okay, you go canoe tripping. You've been on lots of canoe trips. And then you see someone, oh, I'm going on a 2-week solo canoe trip.
Mm-hmm.
Why would you do that?
Yeah, why would you do that? What?
Well, until you actually go out and do it. So they went on a kayak trip, and their perception of outdoor adventures totally changed. It is a universal truth that not everyone enjoys outdoor sports and activities. 100%.
Yep, absolutely.
I have people that I've said, hey, why don't you, if you came, you would have a blast.
What, live like a homeless person?
They're like, no, there's no way I'm going.
Yeah.
Like, I've got no interest in it. Southeast Asians, in general, are among those who avoid spending too much time outdoors simply because of our scorching heat, unpredictable weather. However, the outdoors can often pleasantly surprise many. Now, even I hate the scorching heat and unpredictable
weather. Oh, absolutely.
A 7-kilometer kayaking trip along Sungai Barang in Terengganu did just that for this writer. Organized as one of the wildlife discovery tours by Genoba Outdoor, the experience completely changed my perception of kayaking. Though I have experienced kayaking a few times in my life, I always remembered the activity as exhausting and energy consuming, which would turn anybody off.
Oh, absolutely.
But going on this trip completely changed my perspective and gave me newfound appreciation for the sport. The morning began at Genoba Outdoor Campsite in Kuala Barang, where participants gathered before embarking on an event on the adventure. Before anyone even stepped into a kayak, safety took center stage. Guides conducted a thorough briefing, explaining everything from basic paddling techniques to what we could expect throughout the journey. We were then asked to perform a series of stretching exercises to loosen our muscles, something that immediately gave the impression that this was a professionally organized activity rather than simply handing out kayaks and sending participants down the river.
Yep, 100%.
Which in itself could be fun. Then came what was perhaps the most memorable safety exercise of the morning. Instead of heading straight into our kayaks, we were instructed to walk into the river while fully suited up in our life jackets. Once everyone was waist deep in the water, the guide asked us to lie back and float. I don't think I've ever been asked to do that. I've done it myself, yeah. But I've never been on a trip where people, where the guides have said, okay, now here.
Get in the water.
Yeah.
It's a confidence building thing. They want you to feel confident that if you do go over, the life jack's going to save your life.
Going to save you. It may have looked amusing from the riverbank, but the exercise served an important purpose. It allowed everyone to experience firsthand how the life jackets would keep us afloat should we unexpectedly end up in the water during the journey. Only after completing the exercise did we collect our paddles and prepare for the next stage. Rather than launching directly from the campsite, everyone climbed into the back of a waiting truck that would transport us upstream to the starting point. Nothing like driving in the back of a truck.
I know. We can't do that anymore.
No. Can't even do it in some of the campgrounds.
Yeah.
We did it one year. We had a bunch of us. And I said, you know, let's just drive in the back of the truck. Everybody get in the back of the truck. Sit down. And we got stopped by park staff saying, you cannot. It's like, it's
but
like
we are.
It's like a 30-second drive yeah. or a 10-minute yeah. walk. Nope. Can't do it. Okay. Fine.
Everybody should have hid below the level
right?
of...
Everybody lie down now. With everyone sitting shoulder to shoulder in the open truck while driving through village roads and forest tracks, it almost felt like one of those scenes from adventure documentaries, or perhaps jokingly, like refugees being transported across a remote border in the middle of nowhere. Certainly added a touch of humor before the real adventure began. Upon arriving at the starting point, participants were assigned their kayaks. Although single kayaks were available, beginners were encouraged to paddle in pairs, which made perfect sense. Sharing the paddling duties not only made the experience less tiring, but also allowed for plenty of conversation while drifting down the river. And arguments and fighting. And then came the biggest surprise of the day. The route covers approximately 7 kilometers, a distance that initially sounded rather intimidating. Yet once we pushed away from the riverbank, those concerns quickly disappeared. The current of the Sungai Barang flows at a gentle but consistent pace, naturally carrying the kayak downstream. Even if we stopped paddling for a while, the kayak continued gliding effortlessly along the river. Instead of battling strong currents, we found ourselves paddling leisurely while admiring the scenery. Yeah, if you're fighting the current mm-hmm. and to paddle, you're concentrating on that. You're missing what's around you.
Oh, absolutely.
In fact, I barely realized we had completed 7 kilometers until the journey came to an end.
What? That's it?
The experience feels less like exercise, more like floating through one of Malaysia's most beautiful natural landscapes. Locals fondly refer to the stretch of the Sungai Barang as the Amazon of the Terengganu, and it isn't difficult to understand why. Towering rainforest trees line both sides of the river, create an almost untouched wilderness that feels worlds away from busy city life. One particularly picturesque section is known as the Gate, where enormous trees arch gracefully over the river, forming what resembles a grand natural entrance. Further downstream, another highlight awaits at the Canopy, where intertwining branches create a leafy ceiling above the water, shielding kayakers from the afternoon sun while producing one of the most breathtaking stretches of the journey. Calm pace of the river also provides plenty of opportunities to appreciate the wildlife. Throughout the trip, we spotted monkeys moving among the trees, while birds occasionally flew overhead. Our guides also pointed out the areas where otters were often seen and reminded us to keep an eye out for one of the Sungai Barang's most unusual residents, an albino buffalo.
Oh.
That has become something of a local celebrity due to its striking bright-colored coat. One of my bucket list things to do is to be on a canoe trip and see monkeys. Don't ask me why, but there's just something in my brain to be paddling and watching monkeys in
apparently
the trees.
You can do that in Florida.
Right? There's that one island. Yeah. Although we weren't fortunate enough to see it up close that day, as I saw it only from afar, simply knowing that such an animal roamed nearby added another layer of excitement to the experience. What struck me even more was seeing local children enjoying the river as naturally as if it were their own playground. Some swam happily near the riverbanks, while others took turns swinging from a thick rope tied high on the tree before plunging into the cool water below. Watching them, I couldn't help but wonder whether it was truly safe. Not your kids.
Yeah.
Don't worry about it. Our Naram rangers smiled reassuringly, explaining that they had grown up around the river and knew these waters intimately. The sections where the children played were shallow and had been enjoyed by generations of villagers long before kayaking tours ever existed. The rangers told us if one were to stand in the river, the depth of the water throughout the journey does not exceed an average person's chest in general, so the chances of drowning is unlikely. River itself remains remarkably clean, a reflection of the community's close relationship with the surrounding environment. That relationship is also at the heart of the tour itself. Wildlife Discovery Tour is closely linked to the Naram Rangers Training Program, an initiative implemented by Genoba Outdoor with support from the Hassana Social Enterprise Fund under Yayasan Hassana and Malaysia's Finance Ministry.
Ministry of Finance.
The program trains local youth in conservation, river safety, and ecotourism guiding while educating visitors about the ecological importance of the Karuing Naram tree, a native species that helps prevent riverbank erosion and supports freshwater biodiversity, including the prize Kela fish. Rather than conservation existing separately from tourism, the two now work hand in hand, creating meaningful employment for local communities while encouraging visitors to better appreciate Malaysia's natural heritage. The experience even concluded with delicious meal prepared by members of the local community, making the tour feel even more authentic. Looking back, what I expected to be physically demanding outdoor activity turned out to be one of the most relaxing experiences I've had in recent years. More importantly, I left Sungai Barang with a renewed appreciation for kayaking and for the people working tirelessly to preserve this beautiful ecosystem.
Well,
I'm certainly glad I said yes when my colleagues invited me to join the trip. Even more rewarding is knowing that every participant who signs up is not only enjoying one of Terengganu's most beautiful river adventures, but is also helping generate sustainable income for the local community while supporting conservation efforts that will hopefully protect Sungai Barang for generations to come.
That makes me want to go.
Right?
Definitely.
Especially when you're local. And like I say, they're making food. Locals are making the food and stuff like that. Get to see all the and monkeys, and albino buffalo, and yeah.
That's wild.
And you know what? Like, cruising down a river, it doesn't have to be a deep river. As long as I'm not smashing into rocks and stuff, I'm good. I'm good with that. But there seems to be a lot in Asia now, with especially like islands like the Philippines and Malaysia and stuff like that. that are getting right into the paddling stuff. It's becoming more well known with the tours and like they said, the ecotourism and stuff like that. Now, if only plane ticket prices would come down.
I know. We need to get that.
Places we can go.
We need that airline sponsor.
Oh, I tell you, the minute I win that Lotto 649, millions of bucks.
Yeah.
So many bucket list places to hit.
I'm just trying to find it on a map here. It's on the opposite end of Malaysia from Kuala Lumpur. So it's on the north coast. It's a... You can see all the waterways there. I can see what they're talking about there.
Lots of places to paddle.
Uh-huh. And it's nice to see the care for the environment with the clean water. And like in North America, we don't do that so well. Not so well at all.
No, and I mean, we go traveling down our local rivers here and say we take the canoe, I need a garbage bag.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, people just cast stuff off.
Digging stuff out and throwing it in the bottom of the canoe. And then
leave
the end,
fishing lines hanging from the trees, leave the garbage. And
bobbers,
somehow they get, like, shopping carts in the weirdest. And like, I don't understand. Like, it has to be a winter thing on ice because I don't know anybody's going to bring a shopping cart out in the middle of nowhere.
Dishwashers and washing machines?
Yeah, what do you... Like, it's just... I just don't get it.
I don't. But like I say, we fished out the fire extinguisher. We saw the fire hose. I got a giant rubber duck.
It's just, it's encouraging to see some places are actually respecting the environment and we need to do better everywhere, especially here.
Yes.
Anyway.
Mm-hmm. Onwards and upwards.
I don't want to rant. You know, I'm getting on a rant here. I'm getting angry.
Oh, he's getting angry. He's getting me angry. When Donna Lou Nixon was diagnosed with chronic lymphocytic leukemia, doctor told her she had just 1 year to live.
Ooh.
She was devastated, as one would be.
But wait.
More than two decades later, she's still here and has packed those years with adventures many people only dream of, including stand-up paddleboarding expeditions across Australia, New Zealand, and Norway.
Wow.
The Nora Head woman was in her early 40s with two primary school-age children when she received the shocking diagnosis. "It was a good time, Charlie. I had a great life," she said. After spending several months sitting in the lounge in disbelief, Nixon decided it was time to start living again. Years that followed were not without challenges. She battled secondary tumors in her bowel and throat, enduring difficult periods of treatment and recovery. During one particularly long stretch confined to bed, an idea began to take shape. "I thought, I wonder if I could put a push bike on a stand-up paddleboard." The idea gave her something to focus on. She began planning, researching, and ordering equipment. And then when she eventually recovered a couple years later, she was ready to set off. Now 64, Derek.
Well, hey.
I'm just saying.
Can it.
Just saying. Nixon credits her active lifestyle and determination with helping her defy the odds. Each year she heads off on a three-month adventure. At 64.
Yes.
"Norway has my heart," she says. "It's like New Zealand on steroids. It's incredible. I just feel at home here." For Nixon, the freedom of traveling under her own steam is a big part of the appeal. "I was at home for so long with everyone doing everything for me, which was great and I really appreciated it, but I just felt like a caged lion." Throughout her journeys, Nixon captured her experience on GoPro once she had accumulated two decades of footage. That's going to be a long trip. She decided to turn her memories into a film. "I'm not a filmmaker," she says. "I just put it together a few months ago." And you go, wing it. The 21-minute film, More, named because Nixon believes in wanting more from life, will screen as part of the Gutsy Girls Adventure Film Tour in Brunswick Picture House in Brunswick Heads, New South Wales, Saturday the 22nd of August. the Gutsy Girls Adventure Film Tour 2026 10th anniversary. A decade of inspiration, a decade of community, a decade of being gutsy. Celebrates 10 years of Australia's premier adventure film tour, spotlighting women who absolutely send it. Since day one, Gutsy Girls has championed fearless female adventurers who push boundaries, challenge expectations, and prove that gutsy is a way of life. This milestone year delivers 2.5 hours of heart-pounding action, soul-stirring stories from remarkable women around the globe. Enjoy a diverse mix of films showcasing climbers, paddlers, runners, riders, and explorers redefining what's possible. These aren't just films, they're powerful reminders of human potential. Watch fear turn into courage and determination become achievement, leaving you fired up to chase your next challenge. Whether you're a seasoned adventurer or a big dreamer, this tour will light a fire. So the fact that she was given 1 year to live.
And live for 20.
And has gone on every year. 3 month tour.
Yeah.
Every year. Stand up paddleboard in Norway. She loves Norway.
Yeah.
Awesome. Like you couldn't ask for better.
It's not available except for the Guts Girls Adventure Film Tour.
Right now.
But I did send you the, I just sent you the trailer for more.
Yeah. No, I saw it.
Oh, did you? Okay.
Yeah. But yeah, just to be able to go out and do that and, you know, what a, and that, a lot of people knows that, you know, they just go through the drudgery of day to day life without doing anything.
Yeah.
I get up, I go to work, I come home, go to bed.
I know. Yeah. Right.
And so now you figure, oh, wait, you know what? Start living, get more from life. And she's out there doing that. Good on her, especially after. You say anybody would be devastated getting, you got 1 year. We give you 1 year.
Yeah.
You know, so get out there. The Gutsy Girls Adventure Film Tour. I'm surprised there's not more things like that around.
Yeah.
Like there's a bunch of tour, like and film
this,
tours.
This is their
10th
anniversary.
Yeah. So it's something. I'm surprised I've not seen anything up this way of a tour of just women films.
Very cool. Very cool.
The French Broad River. 2 years after Hurricane Helene already.
Yes, I know. It's hard to believe, eh? Like these
time flies. So nearly 2 years after Hurricane Helene wreaked havoc on Western North Carolina's waterways. New recreation projects are taking shape along the French Broad River because it had just demolished the river, changed the courses, clogged it with all kinds of debris, businesses, towns, buildings, you name it, on the sides of the river just absolutely destroyed. So they've been spending the last 2 years rebuilding. The latest additions are on the French Broad Paddle Trail, winding and wild 146-mile network of campsites and public river access points stretching from Rosman, North Carolina to Newport, Tennessee. This summer, Mountain True and its partners completely rebuilt the Lions Mountain access near Rosman, reopened the former Lazy Otter Outfitters property near Horseshoe for seasonal public access, and added a new paddle-in campsite near Etowah. So the Lazy Otter Outfitters, like all the outfitters were just hammered.
Oh, yeah,
they lost so much, right?
Yeah.
A new campsite near Beach Bluff is reachable only by boat and sits in a grassy clearing along a riverbank. It includes a fire ring, a picnic table only steps away from the water, and under the shade of a large beech tree. Jack Henderson, manager of the French Broad Paddle Trail on behalf of Mountain True, said the site fills an important gap for paddlers taking overnight trips. Makes longer section of about 20 miles now into like 12 and 8 mile sections. Not everybody can paddle 20 miles in a day.
Yeah, depending on your age, health, and whatever abilities.
Weather, winds.
Yep, exactly.
It's a lot easier for folks to do a multi-day trip. Improvements come as recreation groups and river businesses work to bring visitors back to the French Broad River. Last year was quite low, just kind of given debris removal, concerns of all kinds of issues with the river. They had to relearn the river for rafting and stuff.
Hazards are changed. Yeah. Routes are changed.
He says some potential visitors remain concerned about pollution and hazardous debris following a difficult stretch of storm damage, closures and cleanup. A lot of people's concern post-Helene has been, is there pollution in the water? Is there dangerous trash? Is there metal? Mountain True has been directly involved in removing debris from the river. Henderson said there are now orders of magnitude less trash and dangerous materials in the water than there was following Helene. Still, water quality remains an outstanding concern. Renee Fortner, director of programs at Riverlink, said the French Broad river or water quality has generally returned to pre-Helene levels, but that's not to say those levels are the gold standard. 19-mile stretch of the river has been classified as impaired since 2022 due to its high levels of bacteria, including fecal coliform, which is found in human and animal feces.
So, yeah, if anybody's yards get washed out and septic tanks get collapsed into the river, and there's a lot of bank washouts, right? So there's a lot of, you don't know what's like, you know, there's a lot of stuff on shore, on land, that if it ends up in the river is not a good thing.
What got dumped? It was impaired prior to Helene, and the same trend that we are seeing before the storm is still occurring, where E. coli levels, bacteria levels, spike after a rain event. Rain soaks into the ground. Ground soaks.
Yep. Pushes whatever contaminants are on the surface or under the surface. Yep.
During paddling season from May through September, the North Carolina Department of Environmental Quality monitors bacteria levels weekly and shares results online. Fortner recommends checking current readings before hitting the water, but she says generally there are plenty of places with safe water. Every day is different. Water quality changes day to day based on rainfall and a lot of other factors. But in the absence of a rain event, bacteria levels are typically well below the threshold, so it's considered safe. Despite lingering concerns about the river, Henderson said interest in paddling appears much stronger than it was last year, which is a good thing.
Yeah.
Hard to say things are back to normal because there's no normal sense of what that would be, but there's a lot of interest. People are booking camps and the river seems busy in general. The paddle trail improvements are part of a wider wave of investment in French Broad recreation. This fall, Woodfin experts expects to open Taylor's Wave, an engineered whitewater feature for paddlers and surfers, and the city of Asheville is exploring a new paddler beach as part of its long-term effort to rebuild the city's riverfront parks.
Excellent.
So there's a lot of good now coming out of it, you know, like after everybody was concerned after after Helene that, what are we going to do? Just takes time and hard work. Yeah. And
it's the recovery efforts, right? And they're going through the efforts. And you can see where this is a changed river. It was damaged, but now it's recovering. But it does make me, I don't want to go back and harp on previous topics, but when we talk about the fires in Ontario and in Wisconsin and, you know, over Washington State that are currently going on, some of these major fires, when you have an outfitter that relies on, what would you call it? It's not tourism traffic. It's hunting, fishing tourism. I'm sure there's a specific name for it, but people that are coming there to trip, to fish, to hunt and whatever. Mm-hmm. And so if that's your insurance is going to recover you, like Matisse Lake Outfitters, they flew us into Wabakimi. They've burned. And so insurance will pay for the structures, but it's going to be years before the people come back. So you're going to see a lot of these jobs are going to migrate out of the region to new regions they're going to go to other areas, go to new lodges. There's a lot of lodges, fishing lodges and hunt camps and fly-in fishing locations and canoe routes and so on. that it's going to take years for stuff like that to recover.
Yeah.
Because it's not just replacing the building. It's getting the people back. And
well,
people,
it's something after a fire like that where you've lost so much forest.
Yep.
Right?
Yeah.
That's what people are coming up to see.
Well, they may come to see the fires, but you know, if I'm not going to spend major money and fly an expedition money to go and see like just wasteland, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I may want to go catch a 4-foot long pike, but I don't want to just look at burnt hills the entire
devastation,
time.
Yeah.
Devastation. Yeah, no, I want some get out to nature, get to the outdoors, get that feeling of being in nature.
The peacefulness, the quietness.
And you're not going to get that.
No.
So, yeah, so it's only makes sense that people are going to move on elsewhere and find other things, but eventually. And it's something like the wildfires, it's going to be a long eventually, faster than this.
Yeah, it's going to take a while to recover for the forest fires. But, yeah, at least on the river here. Post Helene, you can see that the recovery is in progress. They're getting there. They're starting to reopen some trails and locations, and you know it's nice to see that it's becoming healthy again. It's people are getting back to work and everything is on its way to be back to a new normal.
Yeah, and they just got to figure out what that normal is, and hopefully next year it's just booming for them.
With luck.
And they're not the only ones that got hit.
A lot. It happens every year in different locations. There's always some sort of recovery. Mm-hmm. We're getting more and more of these storms and flood situations and wildfire situations. It's becoming a new normal. And it's one of those things we just have to be flexible and understand that, these things happen and it's time to recover and not point fingers.
Yeah, there's lots of fingers that could be pointed.
Yes. But we're seeing a lot of it, unfortunately.
Yeah. Well, good on them all. Hopefully it all works out.
Yep.
There was Frank Wolf had a buddy that was, they did a little tour. They paddled the rivers, and every night they would stop at a new pub. And Frank's buddy played guitar and sang. And so they did different shows.
4 or 5 years ago.
Yeah.
That would have been neat. I wish I could have been there at some of these pubs. That's really cool.
Yeah, you come off the water, you go up, have a meal, and then perform for the crowd at the bar, the pub, or whatever. And then the next day you're paddling away again to somewhere else. And so they did that. So traditional musician and storyteller Connie will arrive in Leitrim by canoe next month as part of a unique journey celebrating the myths, legends, and landscapes of the River Shannon.
Oh.
Setting off from Dowra on August 8th, Connie will travel downstream with a harp in tow, stopping at 7 venues along the river to share ancient Irish stories accompanied by live harp music. She's on Instagram and all that playing her
harp. This is Ireland, it sounds like. You haven't said.
Yep. First performance takes place at Copper Apple Cafe in Drumshinbow on August 9th. Tour is centered on the story of the goddess Shannon, from whom the River Shannon takes its name. Inspired by Mankin Magan's book, Let the Land Speak, and Connie's own upbringing along the shores of Loch Derg, the project aims to reconnect audiences with the history, mythology, and natural beauty of Ireland's longest river. A traditional harpist for more than a decade, Connie has spent recent years establishing a reputation as a storyteller, specializing in Irish myths and folklore. Each year, a different legend forms the basis of a traveling tour that follows the landscape connected to the tale. That's pretty cool, though.
It is. Very much so.
As well as recounting the story of Shannon, audiences will also hear the tale of Cathelin the Crooked Teeth, the legendary figure from whom Enniskillen is said to take its name. By traveling the river itself, Connie hopes to encourage people to experience the Shannon not just as a waterway, but as a living thread of Irish culture, memory, and folklore.
Her nickname is Crooked Teeth? That's just mean.
Cathelin of the Crooked Teeth. I don't know. Hanging out with the goddess Shannon. Who knows?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a pretty cool idea.
It is.
Right? She's making a point. Yeah, I'm going to be canoeing, and my harp's coming with me.
Yeah.
So, yeah, she's on Instagram and stuff like that. You can see her playing her harp and stuff like that. And you don't see many people doing that anymore. That
no.
aren't part of, like, a orchestra.
Yep.
And then usually it's one of those really big ones. There's one, I saw one lady doing it. She practices, but she plays a whole bunch of theme songs.
Oh, okay.
I get little bits of theme, yep. songs, like Mr. Dress Up and the Friendly Giant.
Yeah.
You know, kids shows traditional and stuff like stuff, that. Yeah,
you expect to hear it.
So yeah, it's just pretty cool. But no, so hopefully it works out well. She's hitting, was it like seven or eight different places along the way.
And that's this month. Next month.
August.
This month now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
She leaves Dowra on August 8th.
That's very cool.
Pretty cool.
Now I want to fly to Ireland and check it out.
See? Airline sponsor.
Yeah. Just need to go for a day.
Oh, I tell you. That'd be awesome. I would do that so... People look at me at how much I like to drive and the day trips I do. Like I say... You know, when we did the lock and paddle in Montreal.
Yeah.
5 hours there, 5 hours paddling, 5 hours home. One day.
Yeah.
Right?
That's a lot of driving.
That's a lot of driving, but I have no problems doing that. The trip I'm doing later this month, the end of August here, is 17-hour drive there.
Yeah.
Couple of weeks there, 17 hours back. And you're thinking, and it's not so much the drive there because you're all excited to get there.
But this drive home.
That drive back, you're like, yeah, that was great. That was awesome. That was, oh my God, am I home yet? just to cover that distance is going to be awesome. Going to be awesome. I can't wait. I can't wait. I think you sent me this one. This has got potential. Like I said, I'm kind of disappointed at the end. They said, well, you know, this has got so much potential to go places. 2-year-old Labrador Retriever is sniffing out invasive species for the Credit Valley Conservation Area. So we know they have dogs that can sniff out platypuses. We talked about that. They take them on the stand-up paddle boards, and the dogs sniff out the platypuses so they can conserve those areas, mark them as do not travel in these areas. Now they got this dog. They've trained it. Conservation Detection Dog Program. First of its kind to pilot in the province, which conservation says can help with early detection of invasive species. The potential for something like this is astounding.
Absolutely. So when it comes to to eradicate an invasive species, like for the most part, we run around and we pull what we can. But if there's a little bit of a root left or a plant hidden behind something or whatever, it's like, well, it's going to come back and bumper crop, right?
Right.
So this way, with the dog being able to sniff out the invasive species of plants, in this case, you can find these hidden roots, these hidden things that might grow back in the next year or two, right? So instead of coming back every season and digging it out again, like I tell you, digging weeds out from interlock brick and stuff like that, it keeps coming back every year. If I had a sniffer dog that get rid of the roots, it's like, hey, here we go.
Yeah. And once some of those invasive species take root,
it is hard to eradicate it.
Yeah, yeah. And you've got to try to think about the rest of the environment around that.
Yeah.
You know, okay, there's the little section over here of that invasive species, but we don't want to kill everything around it.
Yes.
Right? So there's that whole thing. As the name would suggest, detecting the species very early on when they arrived to the watershed. Kate Hayes, senior manager of Ecosystem Restoration Stewardship with the Credit Valley Conservation, explains, invasive species can pose critical threats to forests and local economies because of how quickly they can spread and wreak havoc, ecological degradation, according to the CVC. Across the country, these sorts of species can cost about $7.5 billion each year, impacting industries like agricultural, fisheries, and infrastructure. Hence why out in BC, in Alberta, they're closing some of the lakes to paddling and
to preserve
water stuff, yeah, just to, because that's a big chunk of cash.
Oh, right. Yeah.
That could be going into other things.
Yes.
Tilly, the golden Labrador retriever, has been trained to detect three invasive species so far. The hemlock woolly adelgid?
Yes.
The spotted lanternfly and the swamp crayfish.
So the first one's a plant, and the next two are a bug and a crayfish.
Mm-hmm.
So spotted lanternfly, have you seen reports on that? It's just a weird giant moth with, yeah, wings. And so it's like, if you find it, squish it. Everybody's telling you, it's like, you want me to just squish these things? Yes, squish them. Got to get rid of them. It's an invasive species, and people don't realize it. It's like, what? It's a bug. Don't kill it. It's like, well, if it's an invasive species and it causes damage to the environment.
Yeah.
So it's really cool that you don't think of that these certain plants, and it, like, of course, once you think about it, you realize, of course it does. But off the top of the, you know, it's like, oh, yeah, I suppose a spotted lanternfly would have a very specific scent to it. And so would the hemlock woolly adelgid. It's, although I'm not sure about the crayfish, the swamp crayfish, if it's underwater, how does the dog smell it? But they can smell it through water, apparently.
Apparently they can. The hemlock woolly adelgid is one of them we've been monitoring for quite some time now, probably 8 or 9 years, using staff and monitoring protocol. We're able to cover about 40% of our properties where we would expect the species to arrive. Okay, so they know where it's going to be.
So is the adelgid not a plant? I was thinking it was a plant.
This particular species feeds on eastern hemlock trees, causing needle loss and branches to die before the trees dies entirely. With Tilly's help, Hayes expects to detect more of these critters across the 2,800 hectares of land. I think it's like the emerald ash borer.
Okay.
It gets into the trees. We're expecting it to be closer to 100% coverage, partly because she's able to access terrain that we can't access, and also the speed at which she could cover the area. Also helps that Tilly's sense of smell is acutely more sensitive than the average person's. It's roughly 100,000 times more sensitive than a human being's. Yeah, that's why they can smell the food jar, the cheese,
them
from across the house, because they know there's food to be had.
Yeah.
Tilly has been working with the Credit Valley Conservation for the last 6 to 7 weeks, but she has been training for the job for about a year and a half. Antonio Pelota, owner and head trainer of Working Canine, says their dogs are trained for law enforcement, military, and detection work, like narcotics, explosives, and now invasive species. And see, that's my whole thing, is if you can train them for those things, then you can train them for specific, and in this case, three specific different things.
Yeah.
Right? And I don't know why they, you know, don't have more of these.
So this is the adelgid. I'm showing Sean a picture. Yeah,
the little beetle.
It's a little beetle, and you can see the white furry eggs, like aphids, but it's not aphids. It's their spore, their eggs, their whatever. So there you go. For some reason, I saw hemlock, and I was thinking tree, but it's...
No, I knew it was a little bug of some sort.
I didn't know it was a bug.
In. Yeah, I always think the beetles there.
Junebug?
No. I just said it like 10 minutes ago.
Ladybug?
No, the one in the trees.
Oh, yeah, Emerald Ash Borer.
Emerald Ash Borer.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, they got to find a solution to that because we've lost so many ash trees around here. I want ash trees back.
Yeah, see, like, you can get the dog to now, okay, you're only going to know this one, and you know, like the Emerald Ash Borer, and you're going to know the crayfish, and you're going to know, you know, milfoil or whatever.
Yeah.
Something that's new. Basically, it's still detection work, so it falls under the same training protocols, just the target odors are obviously different. When they were tapped by Credit Valley Conservation for the pilot project about a year and a half ago, Pallotta said Tilly was the right dog for the job because of her work ethic, outgoing nature, and it also helps that she has a strong appetite. We utilize her hunger and her desire to eat as a motivator in exchange for sensing behaviors. Find me some bugs, I'll give you a burger.
Okay.
See, and we had that, the problem we had with Athena teaching her to be a canoe dog was she's not food motivated.
Oh.
So she has a great recall and loves getting in the boat and everything, but we had to do it without the old...
Without snacking.
I'll give you a treat if you get in the boat. I'm in the boat. Give me a treat. I'm in the boat. Can we go now?
Yeah. I don't want food, but I'm here.
But I'm here. We utilize her hunger and desire to eat as a motivator. When working canine got Tilly from the breeder, she was about 8 weeks old, got right into a regular training program with other law enforcement dogs, and she had a four-day work schedule where she would go through a routine of obedience, tracking, and detection training. Tilly would then be exposed to the target odors of the invasive species she needs to sniff out. Pallotta said, placing those smells in a training box that allows her to be fed when she's in the odor's presence. As soon as she spent enough time with these smells, they moved her into the shell game where they placed the target odor in one box out of a few, mixed them around, and they test Tilly to find the correct box. We just add more boxes, until she's seeking out the box with the target odor. And then we set out distraction odors that smell similar but are not the same. That sounds like a lot of work.
That sounds like a lot of work. Like the dog's enjoying it. This is the dog's life. But it's like the training hours for the human is extensive work.
Right? Pallotta says, Tilly has an exceptional nose and has not faced any challenges in finding the right smells so far. Biggest hurdle she might face is the heat of the summer. As Pallotta explains, dogs can't regulate heat as well as humans can, and it could impact her athleticism. Tilly will be out with CVC handler staff starting detection work of the red swamp crayfish, which Hayes says was first detected in Mississauga by a 15-year-old boy last year.
Oh.
Mm-hmm. So that's not been around long.
Yeah.
So if it's just starting, then hopefully they can eradicate it
sooner because it's not as spread as much.
Yeah. We'll have her out within the month, probably at the two locations in Mississauga where red swamp crayfish have been detected, adding by the fall, she will likely move with her handler to Hamilton area to sniff out hemlock woolly edelgids. With the program still in its early stages, Hayes says they are not currently looking at adding more dogs. Tilly could also be trained to find more invasive species as new threats emerge. And see, that's the part I don't get. If it's working and you're able to train the dog, then why would you not get a couple more dogs?
Yeah, well, it's expensive. This is expensive.
I'm sure
process.
It is, but you're talking $7.5 billion.
Otherwise, they're already spending that kind of money. Invest some of that money back in. Yeah.
Yeah. It's cheaper to train a dog than it is to go whole hog on trying to
exactly
get rid of all the.
So,
you know,
the origin of some of these things, like the red swamp crayfish. So it was just discovered by that kid just a few years ago. It's from south central U.S. and northern Mexico. Now, I wonder, is that people moving boats around? You think that's the
source? Well, I know there is a big thing that happens when they dump their bilge water and stuff like that, right? So if they're coming up from the States and then into the Toronto area, they dump some bilge water and stuff's in it.
People aren't smart. Or, you know what? Maybe it's not necessarily that people aren't smart. They just don't know the consequences of their actions.
So, well, I mean, and some of this, like, look at zebra mussels and stuff. How teeny tiny
little
they are.
Yeah.
And then it's, okay, well, there's nothing in here. I can't see anything, so I dump the water over.
Yeah.
Not knowing there's these teeny tiny little
villagers.
And that's all it takes to start, right? Speaking of, when we did the Peterborough lock and paddle, our version of it, there were no zebra mussels on the side of the... And same with when we were in
Montreal.
There was some in Montreal, but nothing like some of the other locks that we've been in up the Trent Severn.
Yep.
Like some of them were absolutely coated, but there was nothing in Peterborough. Absolutely. Like, and the walls weren't even slimy.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Because you know how it gets slimy. I mean, there was some algae and stuff on it and they were wet, but it wasn't like you put your hand on it and...
I wonder if they clean it. I wonder if they power wash it.
I think they lower the water in the locks because they can drain it, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then probably give it a good cleaning. But, I mean, by the middle of summer,
you think with there's the a lot of
heat and everything, you think stuff would have been building.
The moss and there's the growth. Nothing. That's impressive.
Yeah, very, very. I thought that was pretty cool. But, like I say, adding more dogs.
Yeah.
Wouldn't necessarily be a bad thing.
No, it wouldn't be a bad thing, but I do get it. It's an expense. The training, like, look at all the man hours it takes to train a dog. Like, that's a lot. That's a huge investment, and you're not guaranteed that the dog you're training is going to fully work out. This one did, but you're not always guaranteed. So I guess it's as far as handler goes, you're going to have a handler who takes the dog home at night. It becomes their sort of pet, but it's a working dog.
Well, there's no reason you couldn't train it to sniff drugs and invasive species.
There you go. Multitask.
Right?
Yeah. Program the dog with the right settings.
There you go.
Every morning.
What are we going after today?
When you boot her up.
Yeah.
Okay, starting up. Let's download the invasive species software.
We're going to the airport or we're going to the woods.
Yeah.
I mean.
Exactly.
But there's a lot of, there's a lot of things, I mean. Like I say, we started with talking about the stand-up paddleboard dogs looking for platypus.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
There's so many things that you could detection dogs can find.
Yeah.
Just because of their snouts.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, if we can use them more and more to help protect the environment.
Yeah.
To me, that's just a given. Do it.
Absolutely. Right?
Like I say, keep coming back to the $7.5 billion to eradicate.
That's a lot of money.
Where, it's probably 10,000 to 15,000 maybe to train a dog.
Maybe. It depends on, it'd be all man hours, right? It's not really a lot of equipment involved.
No.
It's just man hours.
Yeah.
So.
Train the dogs.
Mm-hmm.
Not the cats. Dogs.
What are cats? Are cats useful for other than catching rodents? I don't know. They don't do much.
No, no. They fight, harass the dog.
The kids are home.
Wake you up in the middle of the night.
Kids are home for summer now, and we wonder. It's like, oh, I wonder if the cats are going, oh, no, the humans are home all day long. They're disrupting my nap time.
I don't know. Anyway, hopefully they start to realize what they've latched onto something good here.
Yeah.
And interesting to see if anybody else does this sort of detection, dog detection.
Yeah.
And that's all I got.
Hmm.
That's it. Complete. Woot woot.
Tootfini.
You got anything else?
No? I do not have nothing to add.
Good.
I'm burned out. I'm tired.
Good. Long day. Well, if you want to find out more about us, you can find us at paddlingadventuresradio.com. We're on Facebook, Instagram, and YouTube. You can stream or download all our episodes on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, iHeartRadio, Player FM, Podbean, Amazon Music, and all your favorite podcast downloading sites. Or just go to the episode page at paddlingadventuresradio.com, and you can stream or download all of our episodes there. If you enjoy the podcast, please share it with your friends, family, and fellow paddlers. I want to thank everybody for listening this week. I'm Sean Rowley.
And I'm Derek Specht. We'll see you next time.